The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Lillian Faderman. A scholar and women's studies pioneer, she's the author of several revolutionary narratives of the cultural and political history of LGBT life and identity. Her groundbreaking book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, is an all-embracing history, from Victorian romantic friendships to lesbians in the Roaring Twenties, to 1950s gay bar raids and McCarthy witch hunts, to the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. Her other acclaimed books include To Believe in Women, Surpassing the Love of Men, and Gay LA. Among her many honors are 6 Lambda Literary Awards, 2 American Library Association Awards, and more than a few Lifetime Achievement Awards for scholarship. Her new book is a moving work of reconstructed memoir, as she imagines her mother's life as a Jewish immigrant in 1930s New York before Lillian was born. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Lillian Faderman.
Thank you. As Laura said, my mother's wars is both factual and an imaginative recreation of my mother in the 1930s. But it's also about being an immigrant woman in America in the first part of the 20th century. It's about being a single woman during the Depression and working when you could get work in the New York garment industry. It's about what it was like to find a doctor who would do an abortion at a time when abortion was illegal, and what it was like for American Jews who had family back in Europe who were in Hitler's path. And I try to explore here what they would do if they hoped to rescue their family to bring them to America, and what would be their chances of success. My mother died more than 30 years ago, and it took me almost that long to be able to write this book. In the beginning, it felt to me as though it were a very personal impulse. I had to do it for myself. I really wanted to figure out who was this woman who was my mother, and also who was the man whom I never knew, the man who helped make me. But I think that it's also a universal impulse, this need to come to terms with who our parents were and how that helped to fashion who we are. And so for me, it was a very important project, very different from most of my work. And yet it seemed it was really a crucial thing for me to do at this point in my life. So my mother came to America alone in 1914. She was 17 years old, which is something I discovered in the course of my working on this book. I did not realize that she was born in 1896. She kept few secrets from me, but she never told anyone how old she was. And when she died, going through her papers, I found her naturalization papers, and on the naturalization papers, there's a place for age. She took a pen and wrote over the numbers and age more to her liking, and I couldn't see what was beneath it, but it was very clearly altered. It was not her real age. When she came here, she had a half-sister who was 20 years older than she was, a woman by the name of Sarah. and a brother-in-law, Sam, and she had seen Sarah and Sam only once when they came to my mother's shtetl in Latvia, a shtetl called Prail, and my mother was 5 years old then, and that was their only meeting. Sarah and Sam came to say goodbye to the father that my mother and Sarah shared. And so she came to America. She lived with them. She went to work almost immediately in the garment industry, which at that time was on the Lower East Side of New York. And she made a friend in her shop, and very quickly she learned to love American love songs and American movies, and she began going to the dance halls on the Lower East Side. She would go after work, and she would sometimes stay out until midnight or 1 o'clock and go back to Sarah and Sam's home and have to get up early the next morning. And pretty soon Sam was disgusted, and they kicked her out. She had to find another place to live. So I start the book with that story, and then I skip 18 years to 1932, when she was 35 years old, still working in the garment industry, still unmarried, and she meets the man, Moshe, who became my father, although, as I say, I never knew him. They had an 8-year relationship. But I want to read three sections from the book. And the first one I want to read takes place in 1933. My mother is 36 now. She's working in a shop on 38th Street in New York. The garment industry has moved uptown by now. And the conditions are horrendous, despite the fact that the International Ladies Garment Workers Union was really trying to improve conditions. They didn't succeed entirely. And there's a strike, and I want to read a bit of that. The first day my mother marches on the picket line, she feels exhilarated like she used to on the dance floor when she was with a perfect partner and they never missed a step. She joins the other picketers in shouting out lusty labor songs. The union makes us strong. Hold the fort, for we are coming. The International. She parades up and down 38th Street, waving her ILGWU picket sign. Did you know that sweatshops still exist? We are striking against intolerable working conditions at Alexander and Schwartz. The number of picketers increases every day, and whenever a new face appears, she cries with the others, "Welcome, comrade." She wants to help bring even more workers to the strike because she's disgusted by the humiliation of her days at Alexander and Schwartz. When Fania, one of the sewing machine operators, crosses the picket line, Mary shouts, "Fania, don't be a scab. Don't shame yourself. Stay out here with us." Fania, heavy and arthritic from sitting for almost 40 years behind a sewing machine, waddles and limps into the building as though she hasn't heard Mary. But before the door closes behind her back, she shouts back, "So how am I going to pay the rent?" "With the lousy wages they give you, you can hardly pay your rent anyway," Mary yells hoarsely. She's dizzy with elation when the other picketers cheer and Judith shouts, "If we had a dozen like this, Mary, Alexander and Schwartz would disappear from the face of the earth." The union gives each of the striking workers a little bit of money every week so they can stay on the picket line and won't have to go looking for work. She still hasn't told Moshe she's striking because she knows he'll say something like, "I guess you were better off in the old country making a ruble a week, huh?" Ass, she thinks, though it doesn't stop her from loving him, and she can't surrender that the hope that someday when things get better they'll be married. She's been counting how many picketers show up each morning, but now there are so many it's impossible to count them, 200 at least. On some days, maybe 300 or 400. Workers from Alexander and Schwartz who walked out of the shop when they heard the union will give them a few dollars to live on. ILGWU members who come to help their fellow laborers. passers-by who are moved to join the strikers by the leaflet that's handed to them or by the litany of abuses they hear from those who worked at the company. But not all the passers-by are friendly. Mary holds a leaflet out to a pugnacious blonde fellow who sneers at her. Ah, you're just a bunch of commie Jews. At least read it and don't talk from ignorance, she tells him. He spits on her before she walks away. You bastard, one of Mary's draper friends shouts at his back. But Mary calmly wipes the spittle off her shoulder. Jackasses like that can't dampen her passion. Another day, an old union organizer, Pauline Newman, comes to talk to the picketers. Mary squeezes up front with Judith, whose hair still sticks out like it's been electrified, despite the red bandana meant to contain it. Judith tells her that Miss Newman is a close friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's and even advises FDR because she knows everything about the special problems of women workers. She worked at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in 1901 when she was only 11 years old. And though she left long before the fire, she never forgot the women who were killed there, and she's devoted her whole life to women workers. After Judith's gushing description of Pauline Newman, Mary is disappointed when she sees the person who finally mounts the soapbox, her hair cut short and severe like a man's, her tailored tweed jacket like a man's too. She wears ugly wire-rimmed glasses that make her look as plain as a boiled potato. Mary has worn shoes with high heels even to work ever since Goldie told her that high heels flatter the legs. But she sees that Pauline Newman isn't the kind of woman who cares about such a thing. She wears lace-up shoes. Mary never could understand women like that who do nothing at all to try to improve their appearance. But when Pauline Newman starts to speak, the hundreds of strikers who were gathered up and down the sidewalks of 38th Street and even spill over into the street are as spellbound as if Greta Garbo were standing on the soapbox. And Mary is as spellbound as any of them. Pauline Newman has a Yiddish accent, but her voice is rich and musical. She talks about a strike she led in 1909 when she was only 19 years old and how it grew to 20,000 working women and how together they made the garment industry safe for organized labor, which got rid of the sweatshops for good they hoped and dreamed. But now, dear friends, there are scoundrels like Alexander and Schwartz, Pauline Newman's throaty voice becomes tremulous, who tried to turn the terrible tragedy of the Depression to their own advantage, who think desperate workers must put up with any abuse, any injustice, starvation, wages, unsanitary conditions, corruption of innocence. But dear friends, Pauline Newman's voice rises to a shout, and Mary feels herself rising up on her toes, so transported is she. We're telling Mr. Alexander and Mr. Schwartz that if they think we're going to let them drag us back to the Dark Ages, they have another think coming. A roar goes up from the crowd. Union, union, union. My mother's throat grows raw with shouting. She tries to hold back tears, but they come spilling out anyway, and she wipes them surreptitiously, a little embarrassed by how carried away she feels. She envies Pauline Newman, who knows what's really important and has been able to put everything into the fight for it and hasn't wasted her life drifting, rudderless and without purpose. Then the stench of manure reaches her, and she looks into the street and sees three mounted horses. Break it up. This is an illegal gathering. You strikers are stopping traffic, the policemen shout. The horses move relentlessly toward the crowd, and people scream and scatter. The approach of the horses seems to Mary like a dream, and she remains as still as a sleeper, but only for a moment. You go to hell, you jackasses, she screams at the uniformed men. One of them pulls on the reins and his horse trots towards her. The horse halts so close that Mary can see the gleaming drops of sweat on its black coat. It snorts and moisture from its nostrils spatters on her lip. Pardon me? The policeman asks Mary softly. What was that you said? His eyes shine with pleasure. Judith pulls on Mary's sleeve. Let's get out of here, she breathes. But there's no place to move, and Mary won't be deterred anyway. Jackass bastard, she yells again, and the cop's billy club comes crashing down on her forehead. Lights flash under her lids, and she crumples to the ground. You lousy bully, Judith screams, dropping to her knees beside Mary, shaking her fist at the cop, who looks on from the Promethean height of his saddle atop the stallion. Fucking kikes, he sneers, and again swings his billy club, glancing it off Judith's shoulder as he turns his horse towards other strikers who haven't had the good sense to scatter. The whack isn't hard enough to fell Judith. Mary, are you okay? She cries because Mary hasn't moved. Miserable bastards, Mary whispers, and her eyelids flutter before she sits up. Oh, sweetie, you're bleeding, Judith says weakly. Mary touches her forehead and feels a swell of flesh. Her fingers come away red. She doesn't wipe the blood away, not even in the subway when she sees people looking at her. Mommy, what happened to that lady? A child asks. And the mother says, shh, that's not polite. That's okay, Mary says. She touches her forehead. The swelling is bigger than a tablespoon now, and she can feel the clotted blood. To her, it's a badge of honor. She goes home and cleans herself up because it's Wednesday night and Moshe is coming to take her out to dinner. She feels really good about herself, strong and sure. Don't exaggerate, you're no Pauline Newman, she chides herself. But still, she can't remember how long it's been since she's felt so good about herself. Coincidentally, just about the time my mother and Moshe meet, Hitler is elected to the presidency of the Reich in April 1932, and his anti-Semitic policies soon follow. I feel like Marco Rubio, excuse me. My mother's affair with Moshe is carried on through the years that the fascist powers are spreading throughout Europe and moving east, and my grandmother, my mother's mother, and two of her sisters, and a younger brother whom she really loved, who was 7 years younger than she was, and she was sort of the mother to the younger brother, as was often the case in the shtetl. The oldest child helped raise the younger children, but they're still living in Latvia. One of her sisters, Ray, has come to America in 1923, and Ray is also unmarried, although she was by this time already in her 30s. In taste and temperament and appearance, Ray is in every way the opposite of my mother. And they have a stormy love-hate relationship, but they do work together in trying to get the rest of the family out of Latvia and bring them to America or anywhere in the world that will accept the many Jewish refugees who by the late 1930s are trying to flee from Hitler's path. I want to read from the 1939 section. This takes place 2 months after Kristallnacht, which, of course, was the devastating anti-Jewish riots in Germany and Austria in November of 1938. Mary, by now, has learned that there's only a tiny quota of people who are let into America from Latvia. The formula was 2% of those who were here from that any country in 1890. And of course, there were hardly any Latvians in America in 1890. So 2% came to something like 200 people. So the quota was tiny. And she also learned that Eastern Europeans are considered particularly undesirable in America. And she learned that without money, it's just about hopeless. You can't bring someone into this country. So she thinks she's going crazy, and she's trying to balance what by now is her very difficult love affair with Moshe and her desperation to rescue her family. So I want to read a section of that. If any tiny vestige of the old Mary, steeped in the silliness of love songs and movies, survived into her 42nd year, Kristallnacht delivered its death blow. That's what my mother will tell me years later. Now it's 2 months later, 1939. After work, she stops at the little candy store a block away from her apartment. She always exchanges a hello with Mr. Solomon, the store's ancient owner, who knows to expect her every evening about 6:30 and has already taken from their racks the Vorwärts, the Freiheit, and their Tug. These are all Yiddish papers. She, as I think I mentioned, barely reads English, which he hands her neatly folded. She deposits 3 nickels into Mr. Solomon's gnarled hand and carries the papers home, hugging them under her arm, anxious to scan them for news even before she makes herself some supper. In the evening and on the weekends, if Moshe isn't there, as he seldom is these days, she's gotten into the habit of snapping on the radio not to hear what's new on the hit parade, like she once used to, but to listen to the news broadcasts of H.V. Kaltenborn, Robert Trout, Walter Winchell. Nowadays, if the station to which she's tuned in is playing love songs, she does chores that require attention until one of the newscasters comes on. Then she pulls her chair close to the radio and listens intently for any words about Hitler, the Jews, immigration. At work during lunchtime, she still goes over to the cutter's table with the others who can't read English well enough to understand the New York Times, and they listen to Jack read what the newspaper has to say on those subjects. She can't remember the days she wasn't glued to the news. At the end of January, my mother reads in her Yiddish papers that Hitler has established the Reich Central Office for Jewish Immigration. Does that mean Hitler just wants to get Jews out of his territory and he won't keep spreading his venom after all? A few days later, the fascist prime minister of Czechoslovakia, Rudolf Baron, is also demanding the speedy immigration of Jews from his country. But to where? In Romania, the fascists are declaring Yadini in Palestina, Yids to Palestine. Yes, Yids to Palestine would be good, but the Arabs are demanding of the British, who have jurisdiction over the country, keep the Yids out. As far as the whole world is concerned, there's no place for Jews but out of it. My mother can't make sense of it all. It's like trying to navigate a labyrinth drawn by some evil spirit. You run here and there through its sly twists and turns that might lead to freedom but end always at menacing walls, black and stoppable as death. When she's alone and the news is very frightening, she can't control her anxieties. She feels impending horror, just as sure as she feels her splitting head and splintering heart. She runs round and round, bumping into furniture, tearing her hair, tearing at her clothes. She bites her lips so the neighbors won't hear her cries and call the insane asylum. But she must get hold of herself for the sake of Herschel and Imama and Avram and all of them. She must keep looking for more avenues to try, though her hopes are less substantial than a puff of breath on the January air. In Der Tug, she reads that the Quakers are starting a farm called Scattergood, and they will take in refugees to work there. She runs to Ray's house. Ray has already put on her coat with the huge shoulder pads that make her look like a football-playing dwarf, Mary thinks. She holds her little pillbox hat in her hands, about to put them on. "Listen, I'm meeting somebody for lunch. I can't talk to you right now." "This can't wait." Mary shoves the article from Der Tug into her hands. "We gotta write the paper right away and find out what to do." Ray reads, her hand pressed to her cheek, her heart. "Adank Gott, thank God. We always grew vegetables," she cries as she unbuttons her coat and throws it on her bed. She looks around her room for some writing paper and a pencil. They hurry into the kitchen where Ray lifts the oilcloth off the table so she'll have a hard surface on which to write. Mary hovers over her while they compose a letter to Der Tug, which Ray painstakingly prints in her best Yiddish hand. How can they find out when the Quaker farm will start? How far from New York will it be located? Will the Quakers help Ray and Mary Lifton bring family members from Latvia to the farm? Tell him Hinda knows how to take care of a cow, and Imama sells the vegetables she grows herself. Mary leans over Ray's shoulder and dictates. Tell him that Herschel can fix machinery. Remember when he was just a little boy, he fixed the broken sewing machine that not even their tata knew what to do with? Tell him they'd be very happy to learn any work they have to for a farm, and they'll all work hard. Mary keeps nudging Ray, pushing at the small of her back. Stop already, Ray yells, shrugging her off. But she writes down everything Mary says. A few days later, Ray receives a formally worded letter from Der Tug's editorial office in Brooklyn. Der Tug is sorry to inform the Mesdames Lifton that it is Der Tug's understanding that for the time being, the administrators of the Quaker farm, which will begin operations this coming July and will be located in Iowa, are intending to bring only 30 German and Austrian Jewish refugees there for resettlement. A few weeks later, Mary reads in the Vorwärts that an Orthodox Jewish group called the Agudah is hoping to meet with President Roosevelt and convince him to use his influence to let in more refugees from Eastern Europe. They're going to promise him that they'll take full responsibility for the refugees, so none of them will be a public charge. Mary rushes to Ray's apartment again, clutching the newspaper, her head throbbing with plans for her family. If Agudah will help, they can have three little apartments, Hinda and Imama, Hannah and her husband and kids, Herschel and his wife and baby, or maybe two apartments will do. Hannah may take in Hinda and Imama. Maybe they can all live in Brooklyn near Sarah, who's their relative too. Maybe Sarah will even take in Hinda and Hannah can take in Imama. Mary can go see them after work. She'll go several times a week. She'll be there as much as she can. Herschel, Avram, how wonderful it will be to hold her little nephew. There's no reason anyone needs to find out about Moshe. As she's hurrying to Ray's place, she sees a yellow cab passing. She waves the driver down. She knows the cab will cost more money than she makes in 2 or 3 hours of work, but she doesn't want to waste any time. She rings the bell hard, and the door is opened by Ray's missus, who always has a panicked look since those terrible days last November, like she's expecting the other shoe to drop any minute now in America. Your sister went out about an hour ago, but she said she won't be long, the missus tells Mary in a feeble voice. You can come inside if you like and wait in her room. That's okay, I'll just wait here on the stoop, Mary says. She's too agitated to sit alone in Ray's dark room. Thanks anyway, Mrs. Levine. She turns her collar up against the cold. In a few minutes, she sees Ray coming down the street, shoulders hunched, her features twisted in a scowl. Look, read this, Mary yells, skipping down the steps, waving the folded back newspaper, the article showing at her sister's face. We gotta go put Kana and Imama and all of them on the list in case President Roosevelt agrees. Ray pushes the paper out of her face. I read it already. I went to find out already from somebody who knows. That's where I've been. The rabbi at Tiferet Jacob, the shul I go to for the holidays. He says the Agudah wants to bring over Talmudic scholars and young yeshiva students, not bakers and old ladies and tailors. It's not for people like us. The last section that I want to read takes place in February 1940. Mary and Moshe have had a relationship for 8 years by now. She's continued to work in the garment industry all this time, and she's continued to try to find a way to bring her family to America. Though Moshe helps pay for the little apartment in which he lives and where he visits her less and less, he will not help in her efforts to rescue her family, and he keeps telling her that it's hopeless. Early in their relationship, he promised that he would someday marry her, but he never does, And over their 8 years together, she has two abortions. And then she finds out she's pregnant again. My mother doesn't tell Moshe. She'll wait. She's heard that after the third month, you can't have an abortion. He won't be able to try to talk her into it, and if he does try, she'll tell him to go roast with the devil. This baby is mine, and I will have it, she'll say. January. She's as tired as if she's been working 24 hours straight. But every day she gets herself out of bed and goes off to the shop. On the train, she's always nauseated. Some days it's so bad she has to get off and go into the station bathroom and throw up her coffee and roll and last night's supper. She leaves for work 15 minutes earlier than she used to, so she'll have time to vomit and then catch the next train and not be late punching the time clock. Her breasts are tender, too, like they used to be just before her period, but now the tenderness doesn't go away and the bleeding doesn't come. She calculates this might be the end of the third month, maybe even into the fourth. She hears the click of Moshe's key in the lock on a Saturday afternoon. This is the day she'll tell him, not that she expects him to help her, but he ought to know. He hasn't been around for so long, she's lost track of when she last saw him. He comes in carrying three white roses tied with a fancy red ribbon, like from a nice florist. He's wearing a new pearl gray coat with a collar up, and of course he's raked his black fedora, one side coming low over an eye, that movie gangster look. She used to think it's so romantic, but now it seems only silly, affected. "Hey, I missed you, doll," he says, pulling her to him roughly with one hand around her waist. With the other, he holds the flowers high so they won't be crushed. "Tell you what, sweetheart, let's go over to the Lethe Lounge and have a couple of drinks, and then I'll take you to a steakhouse for dinner. How's about it?" He hands her the little bouquet with a flourish. She accepts it wordlessly and for an instant holds it in front of her, a befuddled bride, before she tosses it down on the kitchen table. She still hasn't said a word. "Say, is something the matter, sweetheart?" he asks. "I'm pregnant again." She makes herself say it without drama. He stares at her aghast and doesn't speak. He looks as he did 6 years earlier, the first time she told him she was pregnant, a man facing a noose. She sees his Adam's apple rise and fall above his collar, beads of sweat already breaking out above his upper lip. She'd like to hate him, though she can't, because she's been so long in the habit of loving him. But she thinks he's disgusting. Finally, he says, "Listen, Mary, don't worry. I'll give you the money to take care of it." For a split second, she's confused. Does he mean he'll support the child? No, of course not. Take care of it means have an abortion. Get rid of it. She folds her hands over her belly, shielding her baby from this man who wants to harm it. "This baby I'm going to have," she says quietly. It has taken me a lifetime to understand the strength she had to find and did. A conflagration was gobbling up the light from the world, while the man she loved was good for nothing at all but fiddling. Yet she did not let herself put an end to anguish in a padded cell. She kept her head out of the oven. She got up out of bed every day and kept going. That alone amazes me. And on top of all that, at the age of 43, in 1940, manless and succorless, she proclaimed, "This baby I'm gonna have." Her courage takes my breath away. Oh, mama, my hero, I owe you awe. He lets out a long, exasperated sigh. "Mary, I'm still trying to figure out what to do with my life. I still have responsibility for my family, and this isn't the time for me to become a father." Anger creeps into his voice, but she's not scared, at least not by his anger. "You know goddamn well I can't take responsibility for a kid right now," he shouts. "I'm not asking you for anything, Morris," She looks him in the eye, and he glowers back with hatred. But she won't be shaken. I don't expect anything from you, and I don't want anything from you. I want you to have an abortion, he says flatly. I can't. I'm more than 4 months pregnant. 4 months isn't too late. We'll find somebody who'll do it. I'll even go with you this time. Look, Mary, I'm not bringing a kid into the world right now. I'll be bringing it into the world. But if it's here, that makes me its father. He spits the word out. She thinks of her own father, her good Tata, how she would jump into his open arms when she was a little girl. Mein Geliebste, my most loved, he would call her. It's my choice and my child, Morris, she says, much more calmly than she feels. She knows, as though the scene has already played itself out in a dream, that now he'll turn on his heel and he'll walk out. And that's exactly what he does. She hears the tap, tap, tap of his shoes on the stairs. She won't call him back. This baby will be hers alone. She stares at the white roses with their stupidly jolly big red bow. Thank you. I'm happy to take your questions or hear your comments.
Thank you very much. Folks, if you just want to raise your hand, we'll get a microphone right to you. Who would like to be first? Right in the front row here.
That's an amazing story.
Thank you.
And it must have taken so much to write the whole book. It's amazing to me. But did you know any of this before your mom died?
I knew that she had two abortions before I was born. I knew that she had an 8-year relationship with Moshe. I knew about her desperation to rescue her family. Of course, she did not succeed, and they were killed. Her mother died before the Nazis came to Latvia, but the rest of the family was killed. I knew a good deal about my mother because, as I say in the prologue to the book, she really kept few secrets from me except her age. And I think she kept her age a secret because she, as I discovered when I got Moshe's ship manifest, he was 10 years younger than she was. He also, as I discovered through my research, he came from a fairly wealthy family in Poland. There was a class difference between them. That I did not know, that he came from a wealthy family. I learned a good deal through my research. Finally, trying to learn about her. I did a lot of research about the era, of course, and what it was like working in the garment industry and the various things that you would have to do if you were trying to bring a family member here from Europe. But I ran up against some walls when I was trying to find out more about Moshe. And I hired a private detective who helped me find what I couldn't find, including my half-sister. He married. We left New York in 1948. He married in 1950, and my half-sister was born in 1951. And she told me a lot more as well. And we've become great friends. She lives in Florida, and she's a lovely person.
Next question.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed hearing about this and having you share that with us.
I have a couple questions about both your research process and your writing process. Of course, you, being a historian, did all the historical background and on this period, and you have your memories and you have your personal history with your mother. But what other kinds of sources did you draw on to get this kind of texture? And in the writing, you know, it's obviously a combination of the, that research and the creative and the creativity to write this kind of narrative. So that process I'd be really interested in.
Yeah. As I say in the epilogue, I base much of what I say on stories that my mother told me or my aunt told me or I overheard, but of course the texture, there's no way I could have gotten without research. And so I have, I think it's a 6-page bibliography at the end of the book to show my reader the various sources that I used for the texture. I had to do research, for instance, about what you would do in the 1930s to get an abortion. I had no idea, and so I did a good deal of research about that. I had to do research about the role that the International Ladies Garment Workers Union would have played in a strike. My mother told me that she participated in strikes and that she was an avid union member, and once a policeman hit her with his billy club in the strike, and that they would break up strikes riding on horses. So that much I knew, but of course I to get more texture, I had to do research for that. I did a lot of research about the sort of thing that you would do if you were attempting to bring a relative to the United States in the 1930s. She told me that they tried everything, that they went here, that they went there, but she didn't give me specifics, and so that I had to fill in with my research.
Next question, right here in the second row.
I'm curious about your mother. Is this working? Can you flesh her out for me a little bit more with regard to her personality?
And did you two converse in Yiddish? And what strengths did she give to you?
That's a good question. I actually wrote a memoir called Naked in the Promised Land. It came out in 2003. And I talk a lot about that in the memoir. By the time I remembered my mother, it was after the war. The family was killed. She had tremendous guilt about that, particularly about Herschel, her younger brother. And so as I describe in Naked in the Promised Land, there were often what... And I don't want to use the term lightly, but what I think were psychotic episodes. But she would go through them, and then she would control them, and she supported us until she married my stepfather in 1954. She worked in the garment industry, first in New York and then in the Los Angeles garment industry. But with all of that, I thought of my mother when I was growing up. And probably until I started writing that memoir and thought more deeply about her, and then when I started writing My Mother's Wars even more deeply than that, I thought of her as a pathetic person until I realized what incredible strengths she must have had to have me, as I say in the passage that I read. She was already... 43 years old when she was pregnant with me. She was almost 44 by the time I was born. To have a child out of wedlock in 1940, when there was such a stigma attached to that, and then to survive all of that terrible guilt that she went through about her family, and to not, as I write about in the book, my aunt, whom I really loved, and was very, very close to my aunt, but when my aunt found out that she was pregnant and that she wanted to have the baby, my aunt kept saying, yes, have the baby and give it up for adoption. And my mother refused to do that. And we were briefly on, it was called Relief in New York, like welfare, but it was very brief. And she went to work and she was admirable. She was heroic. So I used to think that the strength that she gave me was a negative role model. I would not be like her. I would not make the terrible choices she made, but I've rethought that, and I think writing Naked in the Promised Land first, and then this, having to think about her more deeply, has been, I like to say it's been like 10 years on a psychoanalyst's couch, except I didn't have to pay the psychoanalyst, and so the strength that I thought she gave me was realizing what I would not do with my life. But now I wonder if it wasn't another kind of strength, and maybe it's, you know, may I even say it was a she had it in her to survive, and I did too, and I'm grateful to her for that.
Next question.
And so I'm curious about your attitude toward your father. I think particularly perhaps you found out more about him after getting to know your half-sister.
Yeah, I was hoping somebody would ask that question. I try very hard not to villainize him, and he had his own story, and I was really happy to find out that story. I know that he was 10 years younger than my mother. When they met, he was in his mid-20s. As I tried to show in the early chapters, he was sort of unformed. And I think that his family really wanted him to find a girl with some money, not a working-class girl who didn't read English, who didn't have yichus. Some of you will understand what that term means. What it means is the prestige from your family, from your ancestors. My mother came from a working class family in the old country, and he didn't, apparently. They were landowners. He had ambitions. He was educated. He went to school in Poland before they came to America. He lived near Krakow. He was sophisticated in ways that I think she wasn't sophisticated. So writing the book has been very good for me to understand what happened from his point of view. As I say, as I said in an interview recently, to understand him is not really to excuse him. There were still problems there. He had a relationship with this woman for 8 years, and yet I do understand why it wouldn't have been easy for him to marry somebody like my mother. And it's been very important for me personally to come to that understanding.
Next question.
I think there was a question somewhere over there.
I'd like to throw one in, if I may. Is this a book that you've always kind of known you would write? It's a huge responsibility, I would think, to take on your mother's story.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's a book that I thought I might want to write, but I thought it would be so difficult and so painful that I didn't dare think about it seriously. And finally, she died in 79, about 30 years after her death. That's when I thought I was able to begin to think about it. I'm very happy at the age of, what was I when I undertook the book? In my late 60s. I'm happy by my late 60s I was finally able to write a book like that. But I don't think I could have written it earlier. There's a question over there.
Thank you. My question is, how did your mother take care of you when you were really little? Did she put you in some kind of daycare situation?
Or yes, I was in daycare, yes. We lived in the Bronx until I was 7 and a half, and then we moved to California. And I was in daycare before I started PS62 in the Bronx. And she would work and then come pick me up after work. And again, I realize how heroic that was in the 1940s. I don't think I understood how heroic that was while I was growing up or for many years afterwards.
Any other questions? Right in the red jacket right there.
What would you want us to know about your relationship with your mother before she passed away?
There's a story that I tell at the end of Naked in the Promised Land. It ends with my mother's death. And that is that for years after her death, I was there at the hospital. I was with her. And the way I remember it was that, or remembered it, I should say, was that I was withholding. I wasn't giving her what she needed. I wasn't affectionate enough. And for years, that's the way I remembered it. And then, it must have been, I don't know, about 12 years ago, before I was writing Naked in the Promised Land, I ran across a diary that I kept when she was dying during that period. And I talked very specifically about what happened at the hospital. And there was so much love between us. And I was not withholding. She was on a ventilator, but she just kept going like this. And finally I got it that she wanted me to kiss her. And it was the place where I could kiss her the most easily, and I did, and it was from what I wrote in my journal, I know that it was a very loving connection between us. I think what stands out most for me is how loving she was and how brave she was. And as I say in this book, in My Mother's Wars, I owe her awe. And I want the reader to see that in her, how what a remarkably brave person she was.
Take one last question over on the left in the front row.
I had sort of wanted to ask a similar question, if you had been able to come to an acceptance and a love while she was still alive, which you just answered. But I was also wondering, did you have the sense when you were growing up as how different you were being a child of a single parent and yeah, daycare and what, you know?
I did have that sense. And I think it was probably not harmful. It was probably very good. I knew I was different, and it gave me ambitions. It made me feel that I needed to succeed. But I think too that somehow I had it in my head always that I was a remnant. You know, my mother's my aunt Ray didn't have any children. My mother had only me. Her half sister Sarah didn't have any children, and it made me feel that I had to use my life well. So yes, it was not harmful to grow up in those circumstances. It gave me a kind of strength, I think.
One last question.
I My question is really a comment. And so as an alumnus of PS 76 in the Bronx, as my father having a shop on 38th Street between 5th and 6th, as having Der Tug and the Foets, you know, in my house always, by remembering people referring to some of them as communists and Jews, you know, Jewish communists, I could feel your whole story, and I'm glad to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.